Thank you, Paul. Okay, this is who I am, and here are my many financial relationships that interfere with my objectivity. I want to start with the bottom line. The bottom line is we're not doing well and we're spending more. And so the key question is, how is, quote, health reform going to impact this? If you look here, this is done by the Commonwealth Foundation, and you can see, if you look at the U.S., which is on the right-hand side there, and if you look at the rankings, the pinkish color is the worst ranking, you can see that in almost every category of quality care, access, efficiency, equity, longevity, health expenditures, we come in last or very, very poorly. And if you look at the very bottom line, you see with health expenditures, we're roughly twice as much as the countries, the other developed countries. So we're getting poorer results and we're spending twice as much. So when we talk about health reform, I think that's really important. Here I'm going to talk more about health insurance reform, which is an important part of that, but it certainly is not the majority of what we have to do. So I want to make sure that we don't delude ourselves. And if you like to be number one, which the U.S. likes to be, I'm not sure this is where you'd like to be number one, and that is in health expenditures, given the fact that we don't have very good health outcomes. If you look here, you can see that we have distanced ourselves from the pack in terms of spending per capita on the left, and as a percentage of GDP, we're roughly twice what our trading partners are. How are we going to be competitive and have a vibrant economy and get jobs back with these kind of numbers? Health is hurting, or how much we spend on health care is hurting our national productivity. And especially since it's not contributing as much to health productivity as we would like to see. Well, let's look at health care reform, health insurance reform, and I want to go over those provisions. That's what I was asked to do. It allows 32 million people to be covered, something we all greatly applaud. We don't applaud the fact that another 18 million are not. That's another discussion. But it does cover under Medicaid anybody under 133% of federal poverty. And then you have premium subsidies under health insurance exchanges up to 400% of federal poverty limit. So we are making a huge investment in furthering access for those individuals, at least coverage. It does reorient the system more towards primary care, towards evidence-based care, and that's critical. I want to point out, how many of you use the clinical guide in your work? How many of you use the community guide? Okay, roughly the same. Both are important for what we do in healthcare. And it will also strengthen the public health infrastructure. So here are the major issues. One is that we're going to have a major primary care provider shortage, about 16,000 that are going to be needed in health professional shortage areas alone. And there's going to be a shortage of between 35 and 45,000 additional adult primary care physicians projected by 2025. And if you look at the fastest growing population, though over 65, we're going to have even fewer physicians who have any training to deal with the older population particularly. We're going to have expansion of community health centers. We're going to have school-based health clinics. We're going to have nurse-led clinics. This is all certainly to the good. And there's going to be efforts to expand the primary care workforce, but it doesn't happen overnight. There is a long pipeline. Other provisions impacting public health. Good news is there's no cost sharing and higher Medicaid match for U.S. Preventive Services Task Force A and B recommendations. There are provisions for including quality and cost, the CMS Center for Innovation, that's going to test models to try and reduce cost and improve quality. There's limited but some comparative effectiveness research, woefully inadequate up to date. And then there are these accountable care organizations. We have enhanced data reporting, so we're going to have better information on disparities by race, by ethnicity, by income, by language, disability status. All of that will help us better plan what we do in terms of both healthcare and other services. There'll be a dedicated stream of funding for public health, which started this year at $500 million, $500 million more than we had last year, and goes up to a total of $2 billion in 2015. We have to preserve that. There have already been efforts to use that for other non-health relevant or public health relevant purposes. And then there is the National Prevention Council, which I think is the sleeper, just like in essence, or it can be, depends on you. This says basically that the heads of most other the cabinet agencies, plus a number of the other important people like the head of the Domestic Policy Council, have to get together and, coordinated by the Surgeon General, decide what are the opportunities to improve health by better decisions in all these other sectors. That is the real opportunity to improve health beyond what we can do in healthcare. We have to see how much we make of it, how much we advocate for that will make a big difference. There are grant opportunities for public health. There's the community transformation grants yet to be announced, but could be very important and will complement and supplement ARRA funding. How many of you here have ARRA funding, stimulus funding? About three or four, okay. And then there's going to be public health infrastructure grants. I prefer to see capacity as the issue, and lab capacity grants. And then there are going to be increase in fellowship programs and loan repayment programs for public health practitioners, all of which are going to help us increase our capacity. There will be greater use of preventive care services and improvement, but will it improve health indicators? It can, and it will for some populations, but we have to realize that it is not a panacea. Will there be enough provider capacity? And one question for local health departments, I was just talking to somebody after the last session, do we say in some cases like immunization, well look, we're only doing a small portion, we should give that up anyway because more folks are going to do it, the reimbursement's good, et cetera, or do we say, you know what, we're good at this, we know the population, we should be part, we should do more, and we can be more efficient if we have higher volume, and we should get a contract to be part of these accountable care efforts. The exchange insurance products are likely to be managed care, and one issue is how do we prevent adverse selection, which we've seen in other programs in Medicaid. What about blending local health care coverage programs like Healthy Kids and the current application assistance impact on MA funding? Right now we're, for example, spending a lot of money trying to get everybody who's eligible for Healthy Kids into that program. Well, how does that work now? Does that still continue? Does it continue on a broader basis? Does it get melded in? Does it get eliminated? And MA funding, the administrative Medicaid claiming, which has allowed us to focus on a number of things which we had no specific funding for, primarily chronic disease, injury prevention, things like that. I think what is the most important opportunity for us is to emulate what goes on at a national level by developing locally and in states an analog to the National Prevention Council that has all the sectors represented. As Gene Matthews, who's really the pioneer in health law, worked at CDC, now at Chapel Hill, said, you know, partner up or pack it up. Because we have to, in fact, be able to have those relationships, and we have to be more sensitive to the needs of the different sectors, education, transportation, housing, all those others, and they have to be more sensitive to us. So we need a better policy coordinated approach, and we need multi-sector collaborations. If we don't get those, we're going to have very limited impact, and we're going to be marginalized. There needs to be better emphasis on accountability and performance measures. I know accreditation is one step towards that. It is an important step, and it is going to focus at most in the beginning on process, in the longer term on outcomes, and it can't come soon enough, focusing on outcomes. It's going to require that a lot of small health departments merge, either structurally or functionally, so they can function together as a unit and have all the essential health public health services within their capacity. It's going to, in fact, give us better reporting to track disparities. So we're going to have more reporting burdens, and we're going to have more need for public health information systems that, in fact, interface with others. We have to have improvements to surveillance. In many cases, we, for example, have a local health survey in Los Angeles County. We also have a CHIS, the California Health Interview Survey, which are very good. We're going to have more and more ways to do surveillance, especially since a lot of telephone interview surveys are getting very low response rates. And we're going to have, as I said, much more consolidation. Well, reform fits in nicely with other forms of legislation like health information technology, the health information exchanges. And also with the ARRA funding that has given money to a lot of jurisdictions on a competitive basis to work on tobacco and to work on the problems of childhood and adult obesity through policy interventions primarily in the area of nutrition and physical activity. I think one of the opportunities we have, a responsibility I would say that we've abrogated over a long period of time, is quality assurance with respect to medical care. How many of you are involved in quality assurance for medical care services? We have five and a half. But I think for most of us, it would be a quarter or an eighth or a tenth, because who else but us have the objectivity to provide that information to the public on how different organizations and practitioners and groups of practitioners are doing with respect to key outcomes? I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of folks that would like to have that, but I think that we have a responsibility in terms of public education that we've not taken seriously enough and directly enough. And it's also politically sensitive, but it's important. Our challenges and opportunities, we need a broader range of partnerships, and we absolutely need a health in all policies approach. Who's going to focus on the social determinants of health, the physical determinants of health, the economic determinants of health that account for most of the disparities if we don't? Who's going to talk about social disadvantage? Who's going to talk about the history of racism? Who's going to talk about economic discrimination and others if, in fact, we don't say that those are health issues and that they have bigger impacts on health and health disparities than all the healthcare in the world? Healthcare is very important, but it's not the only important thing. So we need to teach policymakers at all levels about what determines health, about the health production function. And then we need to monitor the indicators in their jurisdictions and let them know the things that they can do to make a difference, to improve health and reduce disparities. I was asked to just focus on one program to just give some examples of the impact. That's and to look at immunization. I think there will be continued support for improvement of immunization system in physician offices and clinics. That's along with the electronic health records. I think, as I said, we can consider becoming contracted provider to administered vaccine for groups, or we may say our job is more the surveillance and trying to figure out if they're pockets and making sure those people get to the needed services as opposed to providing them. We have to increase our health information, our marketing efforts, and our health education, because there's a lot of information of vaccine safety that a lot of parents, they don't get. You know, they've heard about this autism thing. While it's been discredited, while the paper has been retracted, and the individual discredited who ran that, you know, they're still concerned about autism, and they haven't seen the ravages of the diseases that we, in fact, have vaccines to prevent now. They haven't seen kids that had Haemophilus influenza and had, you know, lasting neurological problems, or seen measles pneumonia, or seen pertussis that's killed 10 kids and had over 5,000 cases in California this year, more than we've had since the 1950s. They haven't seen most of this, so they don't understand the importance of it. That's our job. That's our job, to make sure they do. And we have to expand immunizations through work with school-based clinics and to innovate the personal belief exemptions, and I'll spend just a moment on that later. We'll have increased physician electronic health record implementation from the meaningful use requirements and an opportunity to get better immunization data. In our county, we have only about 50% of the children less than 6 in our registry. On the other hand, we're a county of more than 10 million, so it's very complicated. A lot of you have done much better. But the Healthy People 2010 goal was 62%. In July 1st of next year, commentary will be allowed on Medicaid adult health quality measures. And so we have an opportunity there to say, you know what, include immunizations. We know increasingly that immunizations for adolescents, for adults, are very important, and they've not gotten sufficient emphasis. And we have to include immunization quality measures in the national strategy to improve healthcare quality. Now, what about policy efforts? I think, as an example, that every parent who says, well, my belief is you don't really need immunizations, so my kid can get into school without them, the so-called personal belief exemption, I think all those parents should see a video that shows the ravages of those diseases, not exaggerated, but in real form. And let them after that say, you know, I'm not going to have my kid immunized. It would make a big difference. Doctors should talk to parents about that. But it's too easy now not to have all the immunizations. And it's increasingly complicated as the number of vaccine-preventable diseases increases, which is a great triumph for public health, but which is administratively more complex. And then I think we should follow the HCR rulemaking for issues that are determining provider reimbursement of preventive services, make sure that immunizations are appropriately reimbursed. We also need to make sure that, the new vaccines that are coming out, are affordable, and that's an issue. And then we should also follow rulemaking opportunities to include incentives for the use of registries. I mean, if we have more places to get immunizations, drugstores, supermarkets, gosh knows where, and we have more people that are allowed to do them, that's okay, but it's not okay unless they're all part of the same health record and registry. Otherwise, we're going to have all these all this duplication and all this questions about whether somebody's really immunized or not. So we need to work on those things. So in summary, there are a lot of opportunities in this health insurance reform. We should catalog them. We should make sure that we're being proactive. But let's not forget that the major determinant of health is in the social environment, the physical environment, the economic environment. If we don't spend in public health a lot of our attention and time and effort and advocacy on saying those are the things that have to be addressed, and in tying those to the economic strength and, in fact, well-being of the nation, we're not doing our job as public health advocates. I know all of you are up front on this and well-armed, so while I'm not a great fan of firearms, I think this is one place where the word arming can be used, and maybe in the sense of arm twisting. It's up to us. Let's make sure we take advantage of this unprecedented opportunity. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. You know, it's interesting to see, as you look in Washington and among the medical groups, you're seeing more and more discussion of population health and an appreciation that something has to happen beyond the individual patient, individual doctor. And that may represent a real opportunity for us to work more closely with the clinical sector. However, there is a little bit of a trap in that, because the population health movement still focuses on clinical preventative services just measured at a population level. And there's still not a recognition of all the work that public health does in policy, environmental change, social norms, and others. So there's opportunities and entrances into clinical medicine, but we have to make sure that they don't create accountable care organizations that do population health and think they've recreated public health.